Remember when you were starting your career or starting something fresh? Or maybe you're starting now and it was exciting and new and you were learning and growing. You also thought that the company and your manager would help you guide your career path. Well, how's that going? My name is Todd Doherty and I host a podcast called Manage Me. I have 30 years of client, product, and operations experience from startups to retail to Fortune 100 companies. Listen in as I share real-world stories of business and life with solutions you can use. I'll have occasional fantastic guests that will share their insights as well. Come join me and learn real-world guides on how to be the most successful you and manage you. That's Manage Me Podcast and managemepodcast@gmail.com. Okay, welcome back, team. Todd Doherty and the Manage Me Podcast. You know, I love having guests, and this one, I've said this before, excited to have a guest, but this one I actually was losing sleep over last night thinking about it, of all the different areas that we could talk about. Good friend Bert Tucker has joined me today. Bert and I met in, gosh, it's probably been 5-6 years ago, right? And
summer of 2015.
God, I'm glad you have a memory like that, because I don't. But kind of random, you know, neighborhood party kind of thing. And the minute you walked in the door, and you guys will hear this in a second as Bert begins to talk, and I'm from Connecticut, I recognized a New Hampshire-ish accent, wasn't 100% sure. And I'm like, oh, I gotta talk to that guy. And I think for about 2 hours, we broke off from the party, my own house. I'm sure my wife was thrilled about that. We just talked about everything and everything from growing up to sports to all that stuff. But I wanted to have you here on this episode because all your life stories, all what we talk about all the time, has so much impact around whether it's business or people or how people should think about living their lives. So, Bert Tucker, welcome to the Manage Me Podcast. Tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of your journey.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. And, you know, I mean, it's,
you were poor,
don't
boy.
Think my, yeah, Steve Martin, I was born a poor black child, my story, but it's, and I don't think my story is exceptional in any way, or it's definitely unique. I've been described as a Forrest Gump of sorts over the years. But I do think that everybody has a story. Everybody has Absolutely. A reality. And one of our biggest challenges in the world right now is we are quick to judge as opposed to just take a moment to listen and understand. And you can still disagree, but just to get some framework. So for me, I grew up 30 miles north of Boston in Salem, New Hampshire, live free or die. My old man was a truck driver and a teamster and would work all the time. And my mother was like the Kool-Aid mom of the neighborhood, driving the wood paneled Ford station wagon. You know, and she was a savage of sorts. Literally, like, to the point where I grew up playing against older kids in the neighborhood because I wanted to play ball. I didn't care about cowboys and Indians or army or trucks in the sand. And so I would get my ass kicked by kids that were 6-7 years older than me. TJ and JoJo Moore rifling slap shots at me as they were
street hockey.
Yeah, future college all-stars in hockey. But, you know, I wanted to play. And so at 6 years old, she brought me down to the Little League tryouts. That was supposed to be for 8-year-olds. And they said, no, he's too young, you can't play. And then she said, listen, just let him take his 5 swings and hit him his 4 grounders and we'll get out of here. And so, Mr. Cootie, Jeff Cootie's dad, was hitting the balls and knew I could play. So he hits when I dive, boom, throw. Long story short, I was allowed to play.
No kidding.
And they needed another coach and foreman of the team. So she became the coach of the team.
Don't ask, don't get. If you want to play up with the bigger boys, you got to ask. You got to go for it. If you don't ask, the answer is always going to be no. So, be like Bert. Go for it. Hey, it worked for him. It'll work for you.
But anyway, so, you know, from there, I just went through a divorce, got sent to private Catholic school because I was the youngest of four, had three older sisters. And so like, a big form, influential part of my life was being sent to a school where you had to wear white shirts, green ties, dark pants, and shoes. And I refused to wear the boat shoes. So we negotiated with Sister Irene on Hermann Survival work boots as long as I kept them clean. But there I was deemed a bad kid and a negative influence to where kids should not hang out with me because my parents were divorced and I wasn't Catholic. And so, and there's a whole bunch of stories from there, as you can imagine, as we all have.
Oh, yeah.
But then we would go play in Lawrence, Mass, which was predominantly Puerto Rican, Black, and Cuban. And so, because I was kind of a tough kid and just enjoyed competing and probably to a little bit of a level of child rage, but that was my identity. And so, those same parents who deemed me, you know, a piece of shit when I had a white shirt and a green tie on were saying, don't leave Tuck's side because he doesn't take, you know, gruff off of those kids.
I thought you were going to say when you're winning the games for them, they were all happy and glad because you were winning the games, but off the field, off the court was different.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. So that's that right. So that has stuck with me forever. Like that, as far as hypocrisy, judging a book by its cover, because literally I had more in common with those kids who had come from broken homes, single families,
right,
you know, that type of stuff, drugs, whatever, in the home. And even though I looked like the kid from the burbs with the white shirt and the green tie, but
except for the shit kicker boots,
the Hermann Survival work boots. Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, so I don't know how much detail you want to go into, but basically I bounced around colleges, lived out of my car three different times in my life.
Sleeping in your car. Did you hear that? He slept in his car. That guy knows what it takes. He's been there. These people who sleep in their car are driven. They know what they want to do, where they're going, how they're going to get there. Don't mess with these kind of people. They are driven, and like I said, they know what they want to do. And they're willing to go back and sleep in their car if they have to. Don't mess with people who sleep in their car.
Got a little bit of help with school, but for the most part at 19, packed up and moved to Austin, Texas, because I heard it was $26 a credit hour. I was there 3 days later. Then went back to New England just to finish school and get it done and took 84 credits in 2 years, University of Maine in Farmington. Fell into a high school basketball and football job. Got offered a college basketball job while I was still in college. And then graduating college, I had three offers on the table. So I was 23 and I had three offers. My girlfriend from high school, her dad flew me to Ohio to meet his boss, where I would have been selling highway road reflectors and pharmaceutical vials out in the Northwest, which would have started off at like $80,000.
Highway reflectors and pharmaceutical vials.
Plastics, chemicals. I don't know. We talked about polymers and all this other nonsense. And then finally I said, dude, I didn't go to college for this. I could care less about this. But I'm told I'll be good at it. So what's the money? What's the benefits? And he told me, well, you will start your $80,000, you know, full blah, 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 small commission. But within 6 months, if you prove yourself, you should be making about $150,000. And my jaw almost hit the floor.
Yeah.
It's
a lot of money.
Yep. There. Yeah, sure. It was in 1994, 95. Yes, 95. And so I then had another offer, which was I was the varsity head coach at a small school in Dixfield, Maine, where I would have been able to get a teaching job and still coach football at a rival high school where I had been previously. And that would have paid about $35,000. But the smell of the paper mill was no longer to the point where it really was like the raw eggs up the nose when you drove into town. So I knew it was time to get out of there. And I knew if I took that job, I'd be there forever. And then the third option was the $2,500 a year stipend position at St. Joseph's College in Maine. And so I flew back. So the night the guy brought me back to the hotel after going to dinner and stuff and talking about everything. And I went to the bar to go watch a game and got a ginger ale and started talking to some old timer. And we struck up a conversation, and he told me about how he and his wife always wanted to open a flower shop, and they never did. And then she passed away of cancer. And so it hit me like that, like a lightning bolt. I was like, if someone's going to offer me 150 grand with a job that I know nothing about and have no skills or talent or interest, I got to believe I can go back sometime later in life right. and make that money.
So and go so chase the, what you want to do now.
Ooh, that's a big one. Follow my heart with coaching. Never wanted to have a what if. Don't want to look back and have doubts. I can always get that other job some other time down the road. Bert's lucky. He learned early what he wanted to do. He's an excellent coach, personally and professionally. And he knew right then, right there, he needed to take a chance.
So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to leverage the hell out of this guy from St. Joseph's College in Maine on this $2,500 job when I tell him that I get offered 150 grand, you know? Right. And so I got back from the flight. And I knew if I never followed my heart with coaching, I always would have wondered what if. And no matter how much money you made and whatever, you know, you can't turn back time. To me, time is the most precious commodity on earth.
Yep.
And sometimes you don't realize that until it is too late. But as you get older, the value of time increases exponentially.
Absolutely.
And so
you're really lucky though, because you knew that, or you figured that out so early. Like, there's still, I'll include myself in this camp, I still don't know what my why is, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, and you're still figuring it out. And here I am, you know, decades later, right? You think, you know, you're all successful and, you know, raise kids and, you know, provided and all that stuff, but still haven't really figured out the why. So you're really, really lucky that you were able to figure that out so early.
Well, and that goes back further. So, you know, I went from like age 12 to age 40 in the snap of a finger.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like at 14, I got kicked out of my house.
Very mature, very early.
My father came home with this chick one night. We were supposed to have a party. And next thing I know, you know, Kathy was moving in with her son, Kevin.
Right.
And within a couple of months, they were married. And then it didn't go that way. She tried to be the Carol Brady, you know, make everything perfect. And I should have had my ass kicked for some of the stuff that I did and said. Because I gave, you know, if you don't, hey, peckerhead, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And I would say nothing. Bert, you want pancakes? No answer. But it was, even though that was challenging at the time, it made me extremely independent.
Yeah.
I grew up, you know, well and luckily wise beyond my years, while still doing dumbass stuff along the way.
Yeah.
But I had an idea on the big picture.
Right.
And so at that crux with that job, it was, I'm going to bet on myself. I had only one college loan for $4,000.
Which was,
no, I was enrolled
40
in
these days. Like it would, you know, 4,000 back then would felt probably more like 40 today, right? It's, you know, sounds small when you say,
I don't know the exact scale, but I did, I will tell you this. So I played college football right out of high school. I went to Norwich University. I was a complete underachiever academically and I graduated from high school with a 1.6 GPA because I played the system and thought that, hey, as long as you pass your four classes, you're eligible. I can throw a football 60 plus yards. It'll all get worked out. And then there was a coach who I met with in the football office who said, I just drove 8 hours to come see you. You are a captain. You're all state. You throw the ball 60 yards. You call your own plays. And you have an F in 1.6 GPA. And he said all this while he had his hands on my throat where he had thrown me up against the wall. Okay. Guy would have probably done time for that now,
right.
But that was just 1989. And so went to a Division III school, Norwich University in Vermont, played there for a year, came in as the only freshman quarterback. Within not even a week, I went from sixth to third on the depth chart, and then moved my way up to second string. But at that time, I was like, I'm not going to end up owing $65,000 in loans.
Right.
To just get an education degree and be a phys ed teacher.
Right.
Just so I can say I played college football.
Right.
Again, some other things, but I ended up going to Texas when I heard it was so cheap. But where was I going back to? Oh, the job, the decision.
Yeah.
So I get on the phone, I call this guy, you know, Rick Simons at St. Joe's, Maine.
Oh, Maine, okay.
And I'm going to strong arm him into paying me more money. And he said, listen, I got 100 guys that want this job. I'm hanging up on the phone for you right now unless you tell me you want it. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll take it. And the point being was I was going to bet on myself. I didn't need money to be happy.
Right.
I needed an opportunity to prove myself. And so as a 6 foot funny talking white guy who did not play college basketball, I just needed an opportunity to get my foot in the door. So I took this job. I took odd jobs to help pay bills. I would substitute teach. I would, you know, go load a couple cords of wood at someone's house because it was Maine in September, which is what you do then.
Yeah.
And it lived as cheap as I possibly could, cheapest apartment I could find. And I worked all the time. I, you know, back then I could get a tank full of gas on campus and I could spend $6 on a value meal if I went recruiting. So I would substitute teach in Gray, Maine. It was a first year principal. I became a long-term sub. I was like kindergarten cop. I had a long-term sub position teaching fourth grade from October to March. And it was basically the conversation was, I need a guy. I need someone who's going to kick ass. The lady who's been teaching this class is 64 years old. She was a librarian here for 30 years. She kept taking a class. She eventually got a degree. We had to give her a job. And I'm walking into this. The class went out of control. She ended up having a stroke. So he gave me a blank plan book, a blank grade book, and just said,
keep it in control.
Just get it under control. And so I went home that night. I wrote down everything I could remember from fourth grade. And I called my ex-girlfriend, who was an elementary education teacher, and said, hey, I'm going to. And her response was, who in the hell would give you the authority over a fourth grade class with a bunch of 10-year-olds? And
well, they were desperate.
They were, yeah, that's what it is, right? You know. And so, but I would get, he'd come to me like, hey, where are you going tonight? I'm like, Asher Matthews, man. He's in Queens, New York. He's like, that's a long drive. I'd be like, yeah. He's like, tell you what, why don't you cut out at like 1:30 after lunch, after just come back for like an hour after lunch and I'll get someone to cover your last hour and boom. So I would get out of the car. I'd drive down to New York City, watch a kid play, get back, boom, drive all the way back, get back at 3-4 o'clock in the morning, sleep for 3 hours, get up and boom, and go teach fourth grade again.
But you know, that, you know, part of that story is, I mean, I don't want to be so, you know, polar here, but people don't, the vast majority, I should say, of people don't work that hard. They don't have that. I have a philosophy that people who have early challenges in life, you know, physical, financial, you know, there's a whole litany of those. What is
struggle.
A challenge, right?
That struggle.
Struggle makes you successful. If you don't have the struggle, you don't put the work in, you don't have the effort, not to say you can't be successful, you can be, but it's not the same journey. It's not the same lessons that you learn along the way. It just, at least I haven't found that.
And you can't get it in a textbook. Yeah. It's like when Sean Connery in Hunt for Red October talks about when Cortez landed and then burned the ships to help motivate the men.
Right.
You know, like,
we're not going anywhere.
Rich kids work hard.
Right.
But their sense of survival.
Right.
Is follow. So when I started when I started the basketball business, one of the very first players that, you know, his dad was an SEC player for track, but was offered multiple basketball scholarships. We had lineage, and he was a good player. Kid went to Marist High School here in Atlanta, and his junior year sat down with he and his parents, and it was basically the gist of the conversation was, I will cut off my right arm to play college basketball. And I was like, dude, you are absolutely a college prospect. You just might not be an SEC, ACC kid here. And you're wicked smart. So maybe some of the Division II schools here that are state schools in Georgia may not be to what you're looking for. So you have to be willing to go geographically somewhere else, a la the Northeast. Right. And you are a quintessential Division II player up at Bentley, Adelphi, Merrimack College, St. Anselm's, you know, all those academic business type of schools.
Right.
And so, he crushed me because then the next year, the system sucked the life out of him. And he was just like, you know what? I'm just going to go to UGA, take the Hope Scholarship, join a frat and have a good time and go get a business degree. And I was like, that's a hell of a plan B. Like that's, you know, like talk about first world problems like that. That's a hell of a plan B. It's right. A great fallback position.
Yeah, there's kids that would love to have that.
Right. And absolutely. So it's a matter of expectation. But
let's get back to, because we skipped over. So we got to talk about how you started your company that you still run.
Yeah. So, so I coached college for 10 years, you know, kept moving up. The first year was the stipend position. Then the guy ahead of me moved on. So I got bumped up to the full-time position, which was paying me $23,000. I thought I hit the lottery.
From $2,500 to $23,000.
$23,000, baby. And so I rented an apartment in downtown Portland, Maine, with a kid that just graduated from St. Joseph's College. I worked every day. I actually banked $11,000 that year after taxes.
Nice.
And so
salary.
The next year I got a head job in Boston. And so over those summers, what I did was to pay my dues was I would get my stuff out of, I'd get rid of my apartment, put my stuff in my old man's basement, and then I would book 13 weeks of summer camp. And I would come into the South. So I came to Clemson back in the summer of 96. And I would come down here and I ended up working here for like a month when the assistant coach said, hey, you know, you're a college coach. You mind working a couple of our guys out during lunchtime? I'm like, hell yeah, why not? So I knew they weren't going to listen to me. Again, short, funny talking white guy from New England. And so I made everything numeric. So I tracked everything that they did, or I gave them a percentage or a time that they had to beat.
Gotcha.
Did you hear that? Measure it. Measure everything. Make it easy. Measure everything. If you're not measuring it, you can't manage it. It's one of the fundamentals of business.
And so then Rick Barnes came to me, who's now the head coach of Tennessee, was at Texas, Clemson, Providence. He came to me and said, hey, what the hell are you doing with my guys? I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, my guys won't stop talking about you. What are you doing? And I'm thinking, oh, God, what did I say a lot of things off the cuff. I don't know. What did I say? Did I invent, offend someone's God or, you know, mother? Or, I don't know. And I just told him what I was doing. He's like, I love it. And so I was supposed to actually go back and work Providence's camp. And they ended up calling Pete Gillen at Providence to say, yeah, he ain't coming. Find somebody else. And I ended up staying for like a month to work those guys out. Yeah. But anyway, so I would take my stuff and I would work from Maine to Florida to Texas and everywhere in between, working camps to build my knowledge, my resume, my background. The whole time it was I want to be a Division I head coach.
Okay.
But I also saw a need for bringing competent, disciplined training methods to the youth level.
Gotcha.
So I'd always keep the good stuff, get rid of the bad stuff. But then through all that, an older guy just saw me on a court at 100 degrees out in Trenton, New Jersey, on outdoor courts at Trent State College for a company that was called Eastern Invitational back then. It's now called the Hoop Group. And this one, Phil Rowe, was like, hey, Tuck, did you apply for that head job in Boston? Dude, I haven't been home for 2 months. I have no idea what you're even talking about. He goes, no, you'd be perfect for that job. He goes, where are you going to be at 7:30? I'm like, I don't start flipping through some pages. I'm like, I'll be on court 76, wherever that is, you know? Right. He's like, all right, I'll find you. And so he came back and he goes, you have a job tomorrow. You have an interview tomorrow at 9 a.m. at Newberry College in Brookline, Mass. I had never heard of the school. I knew nothing about it other than I knew it was a junior college. And so I go, yeah, but I'm supposed to work here until Thursday. This was on like Sunday evening as it was. And he goes, I'll talk to Rob Kennedy, who is a basketball god. And so long story short, I ended up driving from Trenton, New Jersey to Portland, Maine to get a suit and tie and print off a couple things, drove back down to Boston, slept in the car, found a Dunkin' Donuts because Dunkin' Donuts that were older in New England, they actually were great because you could, they were Superman bathrooms. You could basically go in there. It was a single bathroom. You could lock the door.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So I could go in there, strip wash down, take a washcloth, boom, yep, right there, and put the suit and tie on, then boom, go to the interview.
Superman bathroom.
So I had a 5-hour interview and then got back in the car and drove right back to Trenton State. Boom, put on my basketball stuff and went right back on the court. And I got the job. So I was head coach at Newberry College at 26. My second year, we finished the team that I inherited had players that got kicked out of school for guns, drugs, beating up the coach, actually put him physically in the hospital, and obviously academic casualties. And then my second year, I got rid of all the riffraff. I brought in a new crew, and I actually went after non-traditional JUCO type of kids. So I went after kids with grades that had probably better character, less baggage type of thing. And they could actually get money because what kid that has a 3.5 is going to go to a JUCO?
Right.
So my second year, we finished third in the nation. We had the highest GPA in the history of the program. I had not one kid get written up in the dorm, and I got fired a week later.
Whoa.
For difference of philosophy.
Wow. Even though all the numbers were there, the kids were succeeding.
And when they went to fire me, I brought my cover letter that I wrote the night that I drove from Trenton to Portland, Maine, wrote that. So I was on a day and a half of no sleep.
Right.
And I brought that cover letter and I explained everything that was in that cover letter that I said that we were going to do, that we actually accomplished. And then the only response I got was, you're being terminated for difference of philosophy. And the philosophy was this. The school was a junior college. Their number one academic program was culinary arts. Try to find a basketball team of chefs.
Right,
okay.
Right.
They had no athletic facilities. So we rented gyms and fields at local high schools, other colleges, wherever we could get it. So we had no dominion over right. our own programs. You were always begging for scraps right. from other people, yet you want to build a solid program. And so because we were located in Brookline, Massachusetts, there was a new president that came in that was a Greenwich, Connecticut guy, okay? And he wanted to make it like a hoity-toity blue blood institution.
Yep.
And I was like, but dude, you have nothing to sell.
Right.
What are you going to – you have no four-year academic reputation, no athletic facilities. And at the time, it was $23,000 a year when Tufts – a mini Ivy League type of school in Boston was only 28 grand a year.
Right. Right.
So I'm like,
4 year. Yeah.
Yeah. So, so long story short, Roy Nerschel was eventually brought up on charges of child porn, went to prison, died prematurely of a heart attack in his 50s, and Newberry College went out of business 20 years later. So at 27, I think I knew what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And they had virtually no athletic success after that. Once they took those minor scholarships away.
Collegiate prep?
No. So then I went to Western Kentucky for 4 years. We went to 3 NCAA tournaments there. Then my boss got the head job at UGA. We all came over. And as I kept moving up the ladder, I saw – it's interesting because everyone starts off principled and I'm not going to – uncompromising with your ethics and your integrity and so on.
And I'm going to change the world.
And I'm going to change the world. Right. I have all this enthusiasm and ideas and positivity. But then the grind kind of wears you down. And I've never done corporate world, but I'm going to compare college campuses to that in a way that you have to start to acquiesce to the reality of just what you have to do to where you want to go, get where you want to go.
This is kind of a depressing subject, but the battle gets weary. You get just tired of just battling to make your opinions heard. I actually sat next to a retired Navy SEAL many, many years ago at a wedding. Both our actually fiancés at the time were in the wedding. We kind of got stuck next to each other at this sort of table in the corner. Didn't know he was a Navy SEAL. We started talking, and it kind of surprised me because, you know, young, fit guy. And it just kind of came out. Don't even remember how it came out. And he said he was a former Navy SEAL and he was trying to get into the finance industry. And I asked him, what happened? Like, why did you retire? And he said, I got tired of seeing my buddies die in training. Not on the battlefield, not dying for a real cause, if you will, just in training. And he named off 6 guys off the top of his head. And he said, there's probably a dozen more I can name off of. And that really stuck with me, still sticks with me today. These are the finest trained soldiers in the world. And he got tired of the battle. It hits us all.
You do. And it is not, it is a good comparison. And what happens, because, you know, I've got 30 some odd years in the corporate world. And what happens is a number of things. But if I really had to boil it down, it just gets wearing. Like all that, I want to do the right thing. I want to do the good thing. I want to help people and all that. You still want to do it. Believe me, it's still in your heart. But the battle, daily battle to get that done, you have to sort of reduce the list of what you really, truly want to get done because it's just wearing. It's just wearing to have those many battles all at the same time.
And my naivete was that I'm going to kick my job's ass. I am going to be reliable, best. Dependable, yeah. factual, competent, get results, and that will take care of everything. And that's you know, the naive thought that you have. And so I did a poor job of networking. College basketball is all about network.
This is a great point here, a really important point. You always have to be networking. We've got a tool called LinkedIn that makes it so easy for us. Get on LinkedIn, connect with people you work with, connect with people you want to work with, connect with companies and follow companies that you want to work with, connect with leaders in the industry. You'll start to build a network right then and there. It's harder than ever today as many people are working remote. We don't have those in-person opportunities, whether they be in the office or after work, but you just have to do it. I would say at least once a week. Carve out some time, make time to do it. In fact, you really should do it once a day. Carve out 15, 20 minutes every day to network. Super important. I do it many times, a couple times throughout the week. I started many years back. I've built a network. And what I try to do is pay it forward. I try to help people find jobs, get connected with other people, because we all need help. And you know what? I'm going to need help someday. So pay it forward.
You have guys who have been fired 10 times in their career, and I don't know why they keep getting hired again, but they're buddies with a lot of guys. And so as soon as they get a job, they neglect that job to then work on the next job,
right?
You know?
Right.
And so, and my mistake was I put my career as an assistant coach in the hands of the head coach.
Yeah.
And my head coach, or my boss, did not respect me or look out for me, or the loyalty was not reciprocated. And so as I moved up the chain of command, up the food chain, if you will, and got to UGA, it got me more removed from why I got into the business in the first place. So when Rick Barnes pulled me aside at Clemson in the summer of 1996 to say, "I'm jealous of you." And I'm like giving it the Scooby-Doo, like, what? And he goes, "You get to hang out and work in the gym with my players all summer, and I can't even be involved with them. I have to go talk to this guy over here who gives us money. I got to go play golf with this guy. I hate golf. You know, I need to do all these other things that have nothing to do with why you get into it." And so that kind of always stuck with me. And
So I think you're about to go to the next, you know, kind of your company that you started, but that is that what you just described, whether it's your story, my story, someone else's story, is if you're lucky, you realize that that's happening to you, that
you're aware of it,
right?
You're cognizant,
right? That the reason you did what you are doing, whether it's coaching basketball, whether it's running operations, whatever it is, the reason you started that was for something. You were passionate about some things and you wanted to conquer the world, right? If you're lucky, you figure out, okay, this isn't working. I'm losing my passion. I'm not willing, able, not sure what the right word is, to fight these battles every day, kind of what I just talked about a minute ago. So how do I pivot? What do I do? And I think that's one of the things that, you know, if you listen to the intro of my podcast, you know, I basically say, you know, you went into your career with big dreams and hopes and your manager was going to take care of you. And well, how's that working for you? Right? Because nobody has that passion for what you want to do with your career, your life, your you know, provide for your family, however you want to do it, other than you. Your manager doesn't care, whether it's your manager who is your head coach or whether it's your manager you report to.
The system is a grind.
Yep.
And at the end of the day, people are going to cover their ass. So I would keep a copy of everything to cover my ass. Well, my cover my ass went from a manila folder. Then it went to a green hanging folder with several manila folders. Then it went to an entire file cabinet of CYA.
Right.
Okay. And so it took me a couple of years. Actually, I finally threw the thing away back from early 2000s. But ultimately, I'm going to bet on myself. I know that the best boss I'm ever going to have is myself.
And you want to bet on yourself. Absolutely. And I think that's the big pivot that a lot of people are going through right now.
Hey, you know, these podcasts don't pay for themselves. So I want to let you know that I'm a member of Dollar Shave Club. I've been a member since 2013. It literally costs me $5 a month, less than $5 a month, to get my razors delivered to me for my face and my head. and you have the opportunity to do the same thing. Check in my episode notes. You'll see a link to Dollar Shave Club. You can get your razors, your shaving cream, body wash. They sell tons of products, and the quality is exactly the same as you would buy from any of the regular shavers out there, all the name brands. So Dollar Shave Club, can't recommend them enough. Thanks for listening today. It's always great to share ideas and also get feedback from you. So please send me an email at managemepodcast@gmail.com. Visit my website, manageme.godaddysites.com. In both those areas, whether it's email or website, you can send me questions, you can refer me to sponsors, and I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to have you as a guest. I'd love to hear your thoughts around whether the guests we're having and the topics we're having are working for you, and would love to hear anything that you'd like to hear on the upcoming podcast. Thanks again for listening, and appreciate it.